on ABC Radio and on your pod. You with me, Noel Debien, on The Good Life. Winter solstice has passed, and unless you were an astronomer or you were a neo-pagan, you probably didn't mark it with any festivities. But for thousands of years, the seasons were of great significance for human cultures. They shaped our religious festivals, they changed the way we lived. Certainly since Neolithic times, prehistoric humans even constructed monuments like Stonehenge, and these were aligned to the solstices. These markers were ways of predicting when weather would happen and predicting the conditions for living, ways to plan ahead for the good life. But the seasons are not the same all over the world. The equator's quite different. Australia has the wet and dry. The Arctic has half a year of daylight. Different cultures experience different senses of seasons. So I got to wondering after talking to the pagans. They mark solstice in the southern hemisphere now. Yuletide is now, not the way they do it in the northern hemisphere. So here in the Antipodes, our major Christian festivals are no longer in sync with the seasons. They started out to be in the north, but they're not now. Could this be important? Could it be affecting us somehow, now we're sort of detached from nature in our religious festivals? Could we be undermining the way we strive to lead the good life by sticking to northern hemisphere calendars? So I set out to find someone who might be able to give me some answers on these questions.
I'm Associate Professor Carol Cusack from the Department of Studies in Religion at the University of Sydney. Originally, my main research interest was in medieval religion, but over the past 10 years, I've shifted my attention to contemporary religious trends in the West and mostly research and teach in that area now.
Carol, can I ask, to what extent, when you look at the major world religions and how they celebrate their festivals and times, is there still a connection to the natural cycles and rhythms of nature and the solstices and the way the planet moves?
I'd basically say not very much at all, because the modern world has been affected very substantially by the processes of industrialization, following on from the Industrial Revolution, which began in Europe in the 18th century. And nowadays, things like even the pattern of daylight and dark is not really taken into account at all. Our world is lit by electricity, and people can work around the clock 24 hours. These sorts of natural rhythms are interrupted in modern life constantly.
Yet there are roots. So if we took, say, two major Christian festivals, say Easter and Christmas, they do have roots, at least, in these ancient festivals of the seasons and the changes of seasons, don't they?
Yes, they do, though in some senses that's almost accidental. The major festivals of Christianity were basically arbitrarily slotted into the calendar.
When you say arbitrarily, do you mean just any time, or were they put there for reasons that were convenient or useful?
I think they were put there for reasons that were convenient or useful. Certainly the dates of Christmas and Easter that we celebrate now certainly aren't in any sense justifiable from the New Testament. If you think about Christmas, though, in the classical world, where Christianity gains traction and begins to flourish, and eventually in the 4th century is made the official religion by Emperor Theodosius I, the 25th of December was the birthday of the god Mithras. Mithraic cult's very important for the Roman army. It was also connected to the traditional Roman festival of Saturnalia, and it connected with the midwinter festival Yule of the Germanic people who lived in Central and Northern Europe and who came into contact with the Roman world in the 3rd century.
And Easter itself, of course, occurred at the beginning of spring in the Northern Hemisphere, didn't it? And prior to Easter, there would have been a time of food scarcity, which is known as Lent in the North. These things, I think, are also connected?
I would think so. Easter, of course, bears the name of an Anglo-Saxon goddess, Jostra. She's called Ostara in continental Germany. And even though we have very, very little evidence about her at all, she's mentioned in the venerable Bede's De Temporum Ratione on the Reckoning of Time, which was written in the early 8th century, and which is a very lengthy compendium of information about how months got their names, how days of weeks got their names, how religious festivals got their names, etc. We have a mention of Yostra there, but it's not extensive in any sense. Modern pagans have reconstructed her to be a goddess of the spring equinox and of, therefore, returning fecundity and fertility. And it's certainly true that celebrating Easter in March, April is the time where the whole of the Northern Hemisphere is beginning to flourish again after the long, cold grip of winter.
And that fasting time that occurred beforehand would have been a natural human cycle, wouldn't it?
Well, yes. We have some evidence from medieval Irish and Scandinavian texts, actually, that what normally happened in winter was that there was a very large festival before it really hit hard. So in Irish texts, it's the festival known as Samhain or Savin, which took place on the 1st of November. And this was a kind of way for the community to organise itself and to hunker down in solidarity to get through the cold winter. So a large number of animals were slaughtered because those animals you wanted to keep over the winter had to be housed in your homes. They provided extra heat, but because you needed to feed them and have space for them, you couldn't keep much of your herd over winter. So people would get together and they would have a very large banquet and they would eat probably the last really luxurious meal for about 3 months. Whatever was left over would be salted, smoked, dried, so that there would be nourishing things to eat during winter. And the whole of winter was therefore spent in this kind of period of almost stasis. And the coming of the spring was a sign of the recurrence of the year. People are very concerned with cyclical time in paganism, something that perhaps also is lost when you think about the Judeo-Christian tradition a bit. So yeah, it's natural.
That's Christianity in the Northern Hemisphere. What of Islam and Buddhism? Islam also has a fasting time, Ramadan. Do the major religions of Islam and Buddhism still follow, or did they follow, cycles and seasons?
Let's think about Buddhism first. I think the answer there is probably no. The major festivals within Buddhism tend to celebrate events in the life of the Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama himself. So Vesak, which is his birthday, is the most important Buddhist festival. And effectively, there aren't really seasonal observations, except in the context of what we might call village or folk religion. And this may be because Buddhism, from the beginning, is a religion that valorises the life of a monk and a nun, bhikkhu, bhikkhuni. And so the lives of lay people and the sorts of folk practices that they might have done are less likely to be found within the canonical texts of the religion. Ramadan is a completely different deal, I think, because of two things. The first is that the Islamic calendar is lunar, so Ramadan doesn't happen at a regular time throughout the year. So sometimes, yes, it would have occurred during times of scarcity, but other times it would have occurred during times of plenty. Also, it's organised as a fast rather differently from Lent. Christians in Lent really felt strongly about giving up any kind of luxury, and this usually, particularly in the pre-modern era, referred to food, though nowadays people might give up their iPod or email. When we think about Ramadan, fasting occurs from daybreak to sundown, and that's a great discipline because you're not even allowed to drink water either. But in the evening, you get together and you feast with friends and with family. It's a different style of fast.
Now, quite apart from that lunar calendar that they follow, is it fair enough to think that Buddhism and Islam also originated in areas where four distinct seasons, as they occurred in the Northern Hemisphere, were simply not so clear? It wasn't something that you would mark so clearly.
I think that's definitely true. Certainly in Buddhism, early Buddhist texts make it clear that the seasons are understood as being only two, the wet season and the dry season. And during the wet season, monks and nuns retreated into viharas, monasteries, where they studied the scriptures and meditated. Whence the dry season began, of course, they went out on the road with their begging bowls. And that, I think, is another major issue with Buddhism, that the monastic life, which was so important and privileged over lay life, didn't involve cultivation of any kind. In a European Christian monastery or convent, market gardens and a farm were a natural part of the environment. The monks and nuns essentially had to feed themselves off their own lands. But Buddhist monks and nuns beg. They rely on the charity of members of their own community and also of strangers, effectively. And so that would tend to, I think, diminish any importance of cultivation in that religion.
Speaking of cultivation, the old idea of harvest festival, certainly among Anglicans, was quite strong early in the history of Australia. It was brought from the Northern Hemisphere to the South, but you hardly see it at all now. That particular festival is virtually non-existent.
That's part of that issue about being in a world that's been totally affected by the Industrial Revolution and has to some extent become a global place. It's very difficult for people in Australia to really appreciate the fact that there are seasons, specific seasons, for fruits or vegetables, because since our supply lines come from everywhere, it's always possible from somewhere in the world that you'll be able to get a pineapple or a strawberry right way around the year. And I think that one is less likely to give thanks for food to God when you buy meat pre-wrapped in styrofoam packages in the supermarket. Sometimes it does hit home to Australians, modern Australians, that there is a particular cycle for food. The loss of the banana crop in Queensland in 2006 is one very specific example. People were having dinner party conversation about how it was $16 a kilo for bananas and it was absolutely outrageous.
Now, given that the experience of season in the equatorial regions and desert regions is different to that in the far northern hemisphere, where there are four very distinct seasons, what about when everything's transferred down to Australia, where there's an Indigenous people already living largely in the centre?
I think that's a really interesting question. In Australia, it can be astonishing how the desert will flower and bloom after just one fall of rain, and an immense amount of vegetation that wasn't there a day or two ago will just appear. But it seems to me that in traditional Aboriginal religion, food collection was not something that was tied particularly to times of scarcity or plenty or to any seasonal cycle. Rather, it had to do with a really expert knowledge, so that at any time, whether it was a drought or a time of flood, people would know where to find the sinkhole for water, people would know where to find the nest for witchetty grubs.
Were the song lines connected to this rather than seasonal festivals? Are they somehow maps for this?
I think that's got more to do with individual dreamings for particular tribes. People talk about Aboriginal religion, I did it myself, but the proper thing to say, of course, is Aboriginal religions. Every different tribe has its own set of ancestors, its own dreaming stories, and its own places that are sacred within its territory. So the markers along the land are more about where the Arunta, if you're a member of the Arunta tribe, have their holy places, or where the Walbury have their holy places. But I think in that sense, we could also argue that they are about where you can glean your food from, since particular tribal groups stayed within the boundaries of those lands and lived off them.
Is there anything lost? I mean, these religions from thousands of years ago, connected to natural cycles and events in the cycle of human living and crop raising and winter and the need for protection. And there was meaning in those things, in those cycles. Have we moderns lost something? Is there something missing that cycle connection is gone in Christianity?
It depends who you speak to. I think if you were going to talk to a very devout Christian, he or she would say no, because those things were always add-ons, that the real issue for Christmas is not the roast dinner and the log fire. It's the incarnation and Christ being born to save humanity from its sins. And similarly, the real issue for Easter is not fecundity in the natural world, but the resurrection of Jesus, which indicates his conquest of death and opens the way to salvation for all. So I think devout Christians would probably be reflecting a trend which is active in the West since at least the Reformation in the 16th century of interiorising religion and making it more about what you believe than about what you do. And that's a big difference with Islam, of course, because it's a religion of orthopraxy. Everybody does things the right way rather than what you actually believe. And that means that community solidarity is created in Islam through everyone doing things at the same time. And if you've ever been in a market in an Islamic country, I'm just thinking of Cairo myself, when midday prayer is called by the muezzin, every single stallholder puts his mat down or her mat down on the floor and begins to pray. And you must just stand and wait through it. You can't buy anything, you can't do anything. It's absolutely a point of unity for the community. With regard to Christianity, that issue of community and unity is related to the issue of detachment from or alienation from the environment and nature too, I think. When we look at the census data, 63% of Australians in 2006 still identified with a Christian denomination, but only about 9% of Australians attend church regularly, where the National Church Life Survey defines regularly as once every 2 weeks. So we have a phenomenon that Grace Davey, the English historian of religions, calls believing without belonging, people who still take their cues from Christianity, who are quite happy to be considered a Christian or an inheritor of the Christian tradition, but who don't see that it's necessary to attend. And this, of course, creates a diminution of the publicly perceived Christian community.
Not only that connectiveness, I think, of community might be at issue, because it's only this month, the 1st of June, that Thomas Berry, the Passionist priest and eco-theologian, he called himself a geologian, died. And his life's work was effectively to say that Christians have dominated nature, treated nature like objects, and this is bringing on ecological disaster. And he was trying to drive the will among Christians to see that it was a religious duty to be connected to and to care for nature. Is there a sense in which Christians have lost that orthopraxis, you called it, that right, the doing and the saying being the same and consistent and good?
I think so. But it's almost inevitable in terms of the life that we lead, which is extremely unnatural if you think about it in basic terms. The issue that Berry devoted himself to is a highly controversial one, and it's a controversy that was kicked off probably in 1967 by Lynn White Jr.'s article, The Historical Roots of Our Ecological Crisis, which argued firmly that the whole ethos of exploiting the earth and really consumer capitalism was a byproduct of Christianity, that in the Bible, God may have given Adam stewardship over the earth, but what that ultimately ended up meaning was domination, exploitation. If you were to talk to a modern pagan, nature's very, very important in the pagan revival, or even to a secular, greenie or ecologically inclined person, they would argue very strongly that humans being detached from nature has terrible consequences. Firstly, it privileges humans. They cease seeing themselves as one of the other animals. They cease seeing themselves as part of a huge interconnected system that is all interdependent and is very, very fragile and needs to be cared for and cultivated. I think it's interesting that just recently the Vatican did attempt to promote a new set of seven deadly sins, and ecological violation and excessive wealth, which in the West virtually always results from the exploitation of natural resources, were both in that list of things that the Catholic Church, at least, thought should be redefined as sins in a way that perhaps modern people, even modern Christians, were unaware of or only very dimly aware of.
Those natural cycles are not completely detached, because there are still rural communities, there are still old traditions that survive. Of course, the neo-pagan revival is one, but I recall being in the Czech Republic in 1995, and on Easter Monday, in the villages all round the Czech Republic, and apparently this is consistent, the young men visited all the unmarried young women, and they formed a sort of a rod of smutechni verba, of weeping willow, which was plaited and had little ribbons on it, and they whipped the girls right up and down. And the girls, in gratitude, then had to give them a shot of slivovitz or something, and then the girl was tossed in the river. And there were drunk boys and wet girls everywhere with welts on them. And when I asked an older Czech woman what this was all about, she said, oh, it's a fertility ritual. You know, we're just making sure that their blood's running for the new season.
I find those sorts of stories fantastic. I think that kind of tradition is certainly found still in lots of parts of Europe, Central and Eastern Europe probably more than others. And often it represents a tradition that people may have been doing for a very, very, very long time, because when Christianity spreads throughout Europe, it comes to accommodate certain folk practices, and often issues of fertility, obviously, very, very important in the pre-modern era. Nowadays, we seem to be more interested in limiting fertility, but that's an interesting thought. So these things survive. I was just thinking that actually, even here in Australia, in particular parishes of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox Church, which have distinct ethnic populations, I'm thinking particularly of Polish Catholic parishes, on Easter Sunday, it's still traditional for families to bring along a basket of food to Mass. The priest blesses the food, it's all up on the altar area, and then at the end of the Mass, people come and collect their basket and they take it home and they eat it as their Easter Sunday lunch. So we don't have a total detachment. Some communities maintain this connection, but I think one of the important questions might be whether the connection is maintained because it genuinely is about natural cycles, or whether it's atavistic, it's backward-looking to the old country where everyone wants to, particularly the older people in the congregation, want to maintain that strong connection. I could argue, I think I probably would argue, that they are sentiments which relate to the same issue, the issue of belonging and creating community, both with the earth and with other people. But I think maybe the impulse has changed a little bit.
Professor Carol Cusack, thank you very much for being part of The Good Life.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.